This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Food is like a religion in Durham. It's well known that it was named the tastiest city in the South by Southern Living and the foodiest small town in America by Bon Appetit. But it's also good to remember that the food scene here is relatively new, and food is just one marker of regional culture. Another is fashion, and that is Nancy McKaig's specialty. Now, when she first moved to Durham in the late 80s, there was not much in the way of a fashion scene. But over the years, she has watched it develop and she has contributed to it. Nancy McKaig is the owner of Smitten Boutique and Step Shoe Boutique, and she is my guest this hour on The State of Things. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
So it's the 1980s, and we have to talk about that a little bit because everybody talks about the scenes and how things are changing in the Triangle in general, and here in Durham, certainly food is a big part of it. But fashion was not a part of it back then when you moved here. So you came from where, and what was the fashion scene then?
Well, I grew up in New Jersey and went to school in South Florida and then kind of ping-ponged up and down the East Coast back to New York and then to Atlanta and then landed in Durham, as I say. And when I first arrived, there were very little options for women shoppers. I often heard people say, well, when you want to shop, you go to Raleigh. And I thought, you know, there's so many wonderful women in this community. Why is that? And, you know, in the back of my head, in a mental note, someday I might open a store. And I've, you know, watched boutiques open and thrive. And luckily for me, I've been one of those. So it is evolving, not quite at the pace the food scene is, but we are coming into our own, so to speak.
And when you went to Raleigh, how did that compare as someone who didn't grow up here and was looking for a place to shop?
Well, I felt as though I was in a community of retail that didn't really know the community that I came from. I believe there's a big difference between Durham and Raleigh, as many of us know. I didn't need quite as dressy of a wardrobe that I was offered in those shops. Beautiful clothing, beautiful things, but just didn't really fit my lifestyle. So I wasn't really having my needs met. And you know, was amazed at the abundance of shops that there were that catered to this look and dress that we didn't necessarily have or need here in Durham. So,
well, you talk about back, you know, note to yourself, they have to go pretty far to find a nice boutique or women's clothes or anything having to do with fashion. I'll open a store. So on the one hand, there's a need. On the other hand, the fact that there's a need and hasn't been met yet might tell you it's not going to work here. There's something about the market here that just has rejected the idea.
Yeah, I didn't think about that.
Good thing you didn't talk to me.
Probably. Maybe I should have. I had some retail experience here in town, and I was fortunate enough to manage a small boutique in Northgate Mall, and I knew that there was a customer base that was looking for somewhere to shop. And so when that store decided to relocate, I just decided that was the moment I needed to seize upon the customer base that I had built and grown to know. And I did. And that was the first store I opened was in 2004.
And tell us about that one, where it was.
It was in a strip center on Hillendale Road, Lowman's Plaza. It was McKaig's Fine Clothing. And it was a tiny little 2,800 square foot shop, and we were very successful. We, you know, it was really, Facebook wasn't in vogue yet, so we, you know, we mailed postcards and addressed everything by hand, and you know, kept in touch with our customers by telephoning and writing, and had tremendous success, and it was a great launching platform for us. And as retail and mall shopping changed and the downtown scene evolved, we had an opportunity to relocate downtown in 2008. And I really liked what was happening. It was kind of on the beginning edge of all of that. So, you know, many of my customers just shook their head and said, well, we're not going to come downtown. You know, it's it's just not convenient. And it's downtown.
And that was 2008.
And that was 2008.
Things have sure changed in downtown Durham since then.
Oh, well, and they were great then. You know, we just had to get them there so they could find that out for themselves. And we were happy to facilitate that happening. We opened in trying economic times in 2008, in October, to be exact. And I remember thinking, I'm probably crazy.
Well, wasn't your opening just about the day after or the day before Lehman Brothers went under?
Yes, it was. I remember going to sleep at night thinking, oh, that's not a good omen for opening a business. But we were committed, and so were our customers. You know, we saw that people really wanted to support local businesses. And I think that period of time really taught people how important it is to embrace your community business owners and how to keep your money locally is so important. And, you know, you're only as good as your customer base. And my customer base was tremendously supportive of me and the shop. And we made it.
Well, and that's another part of the marketing, it seems to me. If you're going to be a boutique and therefore market yourself and present yourself as something unique, you really can't be in a shopping mall, albeit a family-owned mall like Northgate, which is a family-owned, locally-owned mall.
Right.
But it has the flavor of something that is generic and corporate, and you're trying to create another image. So that might make moving downtown a little more sensible.
Yeah, it seemed like a fit for us. We are located in one of the oldest buildings in Durham. The house was built in 1880, and it previously, in years past, housed the College Shop. So it has a history of apparel.
Tell us about that, the College Shop. It does have a history.
Oh, my goodness. Well, it's just got good vibes. So when you walk in there, you feel like, this is the place to be. And it was the College Shop for probably 20 years. And, you know, there were a lot of the built-in fixtures that I retained because they were very well made and in great shape. And, you know, many of my customers now shopped at the College Shop. So I hear that still, you know, I shopped here. I was in high school and came with, you know, my allowance. And they're great stories. And Lisa Nichols is the daughter of the woman who owned the College Shop, and she is a sweater designer. And recently we connected a couple of years ago, and she told me that she was in a sweater designer's office in New York, and she saw an order on the desk, and the address said 1105 West Main, and she thought, that's my mom's old address. And then she looked and saw it was Durham. She said, that's my mom's old store. So it was nice to kind of have that connection. And I think, you know, they're very happy that the store is, again, being used as it was once.
What's your demographic? Who are you aiming for?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, we have a pretty broad customer base. We do, have customers as young as 20 and on up. And, you know, we recently had a really wonderful, beautiful experience in our store where one of our customers came in with her daughter who was graduating from Carolina and her mom, and they were getting ready to attend the graduation ceremony. And all three of them purchased a dress for the occasion from us.
Wow.
You know, that they're a family I'm very fond of, but for me, I felt like I had really arrived to be able to outfit those three women, and they looked beautiful. So,
well, and it seems to me that the developing those relationships is important. The idea, especially these days and in the triangle, the idea of shopping local and keeping the money local is important to people, more important than it had been decades earlier. Do people come from Raleigh and Chapel Hill now?
Yes. They do. Believe it or not, we have a growing customer base from Raleigh, Cary, and, you know, points as far south as Fayetteville, and we have a lot of our clientele is Duke alumni whose children now attend the university, and you know they remember it when it was the college shop years ago when they went to school, and they're so happy to shop with us again. So we have customers from all over, and we are very thankful for that and happy. So we appreciate it.
Well, today on The State of Things, I'm talking with Nancy McCaig. She's the owner of Smitten Boutique and Step Shoe Boutique. And we will continue our conversation, find out how you got started in retailing, because it wasn't here at Northgate. You were working at Saks and some other places to get a feel for what customers want and what they might bring to your store. So our conversation with Nancy McCaig will continue on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, which is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest, Nancy McCaig, owner of Smitten Boutique and Step Shoe Boutique in Durham. So we talked a little bit about your other retail experience, because out of college you were recruited for a management program at Saks Fifth Avenue, right?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, I worked with Burdines of Florida, which is no longer in existence. It's merged with Macy's since I was there. But I was recruited from them to work with Saks Fifth Avenue. And I started in South Florida at their Dadeland Mall store. And then I wanted to migrate back north close to my family in New Jersey. So I was able to get into their management program and worked there for several years and learned a great wealth of knowledge from that program. And
about retailing?
About retailing and just about mankind in general.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the retail side of it, too, and then we'll get to the life lessons. But how do you – I mean, which is this sort of this chicken-egg question about fashion? I mean, so much of it – how much of it is pushed by designers, and how much of it is what designers somehow infer from and divine from the streets?
Well, if you notice, you know, every season things seem to look alike in every store. Or similar colors, styles, trends, they're all dictated by, you know, this kind of higher power of fashion, which are the larger designer, you know, houses. Mm. And everybody else kind of falls into place following that.
Right.
So, yes, we all kind of jump on that wagon right. of what they tell us is going to be big for fall. And we, you know, drink the Kool-Aid and believe that it's going to be it's going to be the next big fashion revolution. And, you know, what our job as merchants is to filter down how that works in our local communities. In a larger department store environment such as Saks, you know, they have so many marketplaces that they go to. You know, they have a lot of different avenues to disperse those looks and trends, and some which are a lot more trendy and some that are less trendy. So, yes, we are all kind of on the same track.
How much of it, though, I mean, I am curious to know whether designers themselves and sort of at the top of this food chain, do they go out and notice something in the street and say, aha, I can turn that into the next thing because they've already seen it? Or can they actually whip it up, you should pardon the expression, out of whole cloth and have us accept that this is the thing I must be seen in this season?
Well, I think there's a little bit of both. I think you're seeing a new trend of designers that are really trying to go out on their own and try to be a creative and blaze a trail. Some of the larger fashion houses that we have grown to know tend to stay on the path, so to speak, and just, you know, tweak it a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, everything in fashion evolves. And I had always said, like, when something came back in style, I knew I had been in the business for too long, because, you know, it reinvents itself. It's
yeah.
always a little different. But, yeah.
That's why I never change. Every 20 years, I'm right on it.
Menswear is a different show.
Okay.
But, yes, for the most part, everybody just kind of follows what's mandated by the manufacturers, garment manufacturers sometimes set out prototypes for people to look at, and everybody kind of takes that and gleans it into their own. So there is kind of a standard starting point for most of us.
So that's what happens kind of globally, and we all pick up on these things, and then it filters down, as you say. But now, regionally and from place to place, I was just in a conversation this weekend, and somebody had come back from Charlotte, and they were just offhandedly saying, well, I went out, you know, and we did the club scene and had a great time, but man, I've never seen so many guys in salmon shorts and boat shoes. So she noticed this fashion mm-hmm. ethos in a place that's not that many miles away,
right.
And it was not something that meets the eye here. How different are the trends locally from even one place to another, one city to another?
Very different. And, you know, Durham is even part of that triangle. We are very different from Raleigh and from Chapel Hill. You know, we have our own unique kind of gritty own style. You know, we're dirty Durham, and we're that for a reason. And it's a beautiful reason. I mean, we have a lot of different styles here. That's a beautiful part of a city. We're like a little mini metropolitan area where people can be and dress in their own comfort zone and still be fashionable. You know, style is what you make of it. It's not dictated by a fashion magazine. It's how you feel in it and how you live in it. And you don't see a lot of salmon shorts here.
No, Lord, yeah.
And that's not a good or a bad thing.
It's not a judgment. It's an observation,
right?
And it's just a few miles down the road.
Yeah, and it starts, I just think it starts as just kind of a trend, and it either it picks up or it doesn't. And, you know, God bless Durham. We kind of embrace each of us who we are. And are all unique.
So that's cool for the Chamber of Commerce but for the Visitors Bureau. But now as a retailer, what do you do? Because there are these global trends. And then you got mm-hmm. Durham saying, my style is to look like I don't care about style. And yet there are times we need to dress up. So
sure.
How do you sort of take all of that in and make decisions when you have a boutique?
Well, I think you, as a boutique owner, you try not to be everything to everybody. And you find your customer base and your niche, and you try to stay true to that base. There are many boutiques now in Durham, and we all offer something unique and different to the market. And that's a good thing, because if I don't have it, I can send them down the street to Magpie or Vert & Vogue or Cozy or Vaguely Reminiscent, you know, my sister stores. So you have to be able to recognize who your customer is, be true to that. And, you know, if you don't have what they're looking for, you have to be okay with directing them to the place that they'll be helped.
You have to make decisions early on about what you're going to bring into that store, and there's limited space. I would guess it could keep you up night saying, okay, I put in the order. This better work.
Oh, yeah. There's that.
Right?
Yes. You do. I've been in it for a long time now, so I always feel pretty confident. I have tried and true lines that we carry, that we know our customers love, and we, you know, as long as they stay tried and true to who they are, we stay tried and true to them, and we have a lot of repeat business for that. And I think most merchants are like that. And yes, there are many things that I have gone out on a limb and thought, how can this not sell? and it doesn't. But, you know, those are lessons that you learn. You have to make those mistakes in order to remember them the next time you're so sure that you're going to go out on a limb. You know, business is a lot different. There, you know, back in the early 80s, businesses had that expendable income, that little pocket change, so to speak, for a business that we could experiment or try something new. It's the times are a little bit more trying. You know, we're all to the penny and to the dollar, so we don't have the flexibility with our open to buy plans to kind of experiment and go out on a limb. So you're very, very cautious about that.
What has changed? Why has that changed?
Well, I think people's expendable incomes have changed.
Yeah.
People don't have as much money to spend on clothing and accessories. You know, women still like to shop for clothing and accessories and shoes. But you have to make it a purchase that is worthy of their investment. Yeah. And worthy has several different definitions, you know, value, but also it's not a one season item that they'll be able to wear over time and get, you know, several, you know, different types of use out of. You have to be very conscious of that. You know, we're very conscious of people have a choice of where they spend their money and how they spend their money. And we respect that. And I've seen, you know, ebbs and flows of that in the past 10 years. And, you know, people who normally would buy a complete outfit with all the accessory items, just buy maybe one piece of that outfit or two, you know, because their budgets, you know, have some constraints on them that they didn't.
That's just interesting to hear because, you know, we're assuming that people who are shopping at your store are not at the lowest end of the wealth scale. And yet you're saying in these middle and middle upper echelons, people are pinched too, which
sure.
is to say that what we had considered sort of the ever upward mobility of lifestyle in America is turned around. We can't expect that anymore.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's a big change. And let's see who's the winners and the losers are in this whole thing. You talked about life lessons at Saks as well. What are some of the big lessons you learned?
Well, I knew I didn't want to live and work in New York for the rest of my life. That was one of them. And I just really enjoyed the face-to-face customer interaction that I had. That's the part of my business that I love, working on the floor, the sales floor, with my customers, helping them feel good about themselves. Treating people, all people with respect was something that I learned early on by one of my oldest and wisest mentors at Saks that, you know, she was very quick to tell me you never judge anyone that walks through your department or your front door by their appearance or what you think they are looking for or what they're expressing their needs are. You never know the backstory on that person, you know, what's going on in their life at that moment. You know, they may be a little grouchy or disgruntled for a reason. And, you know, my job and my staff's job is to make their experience in our store pleasant. And that's probably the most valuable lesson that I learned is that, you know, we treat everyone with respect. Regardless of their budget, regardless of what they're there for, regardless of why they're there. And I think that's kind of a lesson that transcends through life.
Yeah, if we could walk through life thinking that.
Exactly.
Saying, there might be something deeper than what's going on there.
Right,
Cut off in your car is not the worst thing that can happen. What
exactly.
happened to the guy who cut me off, that might have been something worthy of my attention. And also, I guess, you must never let it cross your mind, a thought like, you went out in that? You can't ever think that to yourself, huh?
Yeah. Well, you think it to yourself sometimes, but you kind of have that moment where we all have those moments, you know, and you just, you can't be judgmental and you have to just let, every person has a story.
Yeah.
And every person has a moment and, you know, their moment and their story and our store is their own and we try to address it accordingly. So.
You're in a tough place as a retailer, it seems to me, because you can maybe know what your market wants and your customers want, but you're not a designer
right. And
you're not a manufacturer, so you can't really control the trends. The other thing is can't control so much where the clothing is manufactured, and yet do you have a responsibility? I know when of course comes to mind is the Bangladesh garment factory collapse 2.5 months ago.
We do. You as a merchant, you do have a responsibility. And we do have things that are made in Asia in our store, as most stores do. But we are very conscious. We have more things in our store, in our lineup, our product lineup, that are made in the United States. And it's difficult to find those items. You know, we do an active search with our merchants, but the merchants that we do business with, for the most part, manufacture in the U.S. or in free trade countries. And I think as a business owner, you owe that to your community and to the world that we live in. That was a tragedy. And you know, unless that tragedy had happened, like many things, we're oblivious to that. Mm. I mean,
yeah, but there have been other episodes and other events, and people are more. I mean, the reason there's a fair trade movement is because there were previous episodes like that, and at least you know, educated shoppers are aware of that kind of thing. Do your shoppers ask? Do
yes.
they care?
Yes, many of them do. Some of them don't, but yeah. many of them do. Yeah. And I think many of them, I think, trust us to be stewards of that, to offer things that they know are produced and manufactured in appropriate conditions. So I would at least hope that they do, because we do. But yeah, we do have a lot of new customers that come in and ask.
You're a business owner and a mother of two.
Yes.
And one of your sons is severely autistic. Tell
yes.
us about owning a business, running a business, and being a mom, particularly under those conditions.
Well, owning a business, one, is challenging. Being a parent is challenging. yes, I have two sons, Harrison and Will. My youngest son, William, is profoundly autistic, and it's a struggle that's different from raising a normally developed child. There's struggles. Every parenting issue every parent has struggles. Mine were just a little different with him. I was very fortunate to have services for him that, assisted me with home care.
When did you realize he was autistic?
Shortly after, probably when he was about two, he was missing some really major, major milestones. And he was premature, but, we kind of heard from some of the pediatricians that, he was a boy, he was a large birth weight, even though he's premature, he'll probably catch up. But having my older child be a normally developed child, I just had a sense that there was something else. And indeed there was. We began to have genetic testing and a lot of testing done at Lennox Baker and Duke Children's Hospital, and found that he, was indeed autistic. And, as a parent, you automatically go through a whole range of emotions, from everything from denial to anger to sad, why me? I have the worst, how can this be, And then I think for me, anyway, I went into the mode of, okay, this is our life and we're going to deal with it and manage it and have a sense of humor about it. And we do. And there are days where we don't have a sense of humor and, just are more struggles than others. But, we've made it. He will be 17 in September, and he last year moved into a group home here in Durham and is thriving.
Yeah. But what was it? What was that decision like for you?
Well, my oldest son was starting his freshman year at the West Virginia University. And so I had planned, that you're always looking forward to. It's like, goodbye.
Right. I'll pack for you here.
Right, exactly. Call if you need anything. But I had known I'm a single parent, and my oldest son, Harrison, was a tremendous help to me raising Will. And I knew that shortly after he moved and started his life that I needed to make some decisions about Will's care. I didn't want to make those decisions 10 years down the road when Will was an adult, and I had to make those decisions. So I began to be proactive about looking for group homes and facilities that, would be able to be a long-term option for him. I had always heard from all of our case managers that you needed to start that early, and because the likelihood of a child getting placed right away is very slim. Well, of course, Harrison went away to college, and, we got word just a couple of weeks later that there was a place for Will. So I went from single mom, two boys, business, to no one in my home. And they did great. My adjustment was a little bit more difficult, but it was a very, very hard decision. And that decision, it was a transition that he didn't make, that choice. I made it for him. But I, as his parent and his guardian, had to make sure that he was well taken care of. And he's thriving. Yeah. He had a great year at school, and he's here in Durham, so we see him quite regularly. And He's doing very, very well.
On the State of Things today, my guest, Nancy McCaig, the owner of Smitten Boutique and Step Shoe Boutique in Durham. And we will talk more with Nancy as our program continues. Stay with us. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Nancy McCaig, the owner of Smitten Boutique and Step Shoe Boutique, a businesswoman in Durham, North Carolina, a mother of two boys, Harrison and Will. And we were talking about them before the break. Will, profoundly autistic, doing well now. He's away at school, away here in Durham. But talk about the decision and how that is when you're a mother of two and you have one son who has one set of needs, autism, another who doesn't, and you have to somehow balance that fairness question. And so how was it for Harrison all this time?
I think now that he's on the end of it, you know, he's a rising sophomore at school, he would probably tell you that it wasn't that bad. But he endured a lot and helped me tremendously with Will. And he was always very respectful of the long hours that I would have to work and, you know, help me with the care for his brother. His brother was very, very, is very still attached to him, and he is to his brother. You know, and I felt very fortunate to have a child like Harrison because, you know, without him, I don't necessarily know if I could have made my way through all of that as easily as I did. At some point you just have that kind of conversation with your child that is not the child with special needs that guess, you know, our life's not like everybody else. Guess what? You know, we're not going to have the postcard picture for Christmas with the three of us and the family dog. And you have to learn to embrace the moments that are beautiful in your family. And you have to learn to laugh at the moments that sometimes make you want to cry and pull your hair out. And you have to just learn to be pensive and thoughtful about those moments that you just can't change. And there were lots of them, you know, daily. And he made a lot of sacrifices that have really made him into a very, very compassionate young man.
He's working with people with disabilities?
He does. He actually is a HAB tech in homes similar to what we had with Will in our home. And, you know, I can remember asking him when he kind of ventured into that as a part-time summer job, you know, I said, are you sure you want to do that? And I'm good at it, Mom. And he is. He's very good at it.
He's good at it, and he has to like it.
Yeah, he does. He's very compassionate. He is a very, very compassionate young man. And I think, you know, he has his brother a lot to thank for that, but he is his own person and has really has a great view of life and mankind. So,
Will is eligible for Medicaid.
Yes.
You're a successful businesswoman. How could you have done it without Medicaid?
No, that's probably another show, but yes, I never could have done it. You know, I had care that would pick Will up off of the bus and take him to my home and get him, you know, dinner and ready for bed. And I would be home naturally to put him to bed and, you know, the last couple of hours of his evening. I would have never, ever been able to do that without those services. And, you know, I think people lose sight of the fact that, you know, Medicaid is helping children and people like Will. And there are people like Will who have parents like me who contribute a lot to that system. And, you know, it's the cycle of life. We have to help these people. And, you know, I have to help them as a business owner. So
I wonder what you felt when you what you thought about when you noticed that this legislature has denied service to 500 million
people. It makes
me
very sad. Very, very sad.
500,000, I should say.
Yeah. It makes me very sad because I know that there are an abundance of children and people out there like my Will that are not getting services that they need. And, you know, it takes more than a village to raise a child like Will. And you can't do it alone. You have to have help. And, you know, we as a community, we as a society, we have to help these people. We can't turn our backs to them. So Yeah,
And it seems, I mean, one of the arguments is that the taxes become a burden on people. You're a small business. Nothing that was going on in the state apparently put you out of business in the years leading up to this.
This is my spin on taxes. If I'm successful, and I've been very successful and very fortunate, I'm happy to pay my share to help those that need the help. And that's just my take on it. And maybe because I've benefited from some of those services, I have a different view of it. Mm-hmm. When we rise up, everybody rises. And yeah. That's how I was raised and how I kind of view the world. And I've seen it firsthand what it's been able to do for me and my family.
And you've been active in this community in a lot of other charitable pursuits. I know you're very active with the Dress for Success program.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, Dress for Success is an organization based out of Northgate Mall. Pat Nathan is the executive director, and we are very, very proud to be associated with them. It's a program that women need to be referred to. It provides job skill training, interview training, life skill training, and also wardrobe consultation, what people need to go out and face the interview process, the workforce.
And the wardrobes, right? So that provide clothes.
Yes.
And the job training and the job skills training to go with.
Yes.
It.
The clothing is just really a small part of it. The skills training that they provide these women is just paramount. It's an unbelievable organization, and we are just very, very proud to be a part of it. And I encourage everyone who is not familiar with it to familiarize yourself with it. And if there's any way that they can participate or help, please do.
Dress for Success operates out of the Northgate Mall, as you said. It's interesting to think about it because sometimes when we think about fashion, those of us who quite apparently just pay little attention to it can be prone to think, well, you know, why are we spending this much time thinking about what we're going to put on our backs when we could be out there doing other things? It is important to a sense of self-esteem. And if you're a woman who has not had much job success or skill in the past, and now you're going to get out in the workplace, feeling like, you know, that you have a sense of self-esteem, that you're worthy of this job, it's a package. How I look, whether
Absolutely.
I'm prepared, if I know how to fill out a resume, do I know the job interview skills, all of that is provided. And then you can go out and say, now I fit these clothes, and these
Right.
clothes fit the job, and I'm fit to sit in this chair across from that personnel director.
Absolutely. Yeah. And some of the stories that, you know, I've been fortunate enough to hear of women that have just had amazing turnarounds in their life because of this. When you think it's, you know, I and not to make light of, it's just a little program that, you know, it's a short, but wow, I mean, this has changed, you know, people have been able to go from being on subsidized, you know, funding, Medicaid, to being self-sufficient. They're productive, you know, members of our communities. And that's, you know, how good they feel about themselves. It's just amazing to
see. Well, and it points to something I think that's a real misunderstanding, somehow that people who don't have jobs, who may be on some form of public assistance because they're not working or don't have enough work to feed a family, somehow aren't interested in it. And these are people who are tremendously interested in getting out of the workplace and doing
sure.
things.
Oh.
But you need skills and you do need a certain amount of money to begin with so that you look fit for the job. All of those things you can't deny. And if you deny people the basics of food and medicine and housing, then how are they going to get a job and how are they going to feel like they
right.
belong in that? So programs like this are great, but it's too bad we need so many of them because in the public sector, we're simply not providing enough.
Right.
But you're doing that, and that's a good thing. That one's Dress for Success. And then there's another program called Porch Durham that you're
yes.
involved in. Tell us about
yes.
that one.
Well, Porch Durham is a food drive that takes place monthly in communities in Durham, particularly the backpack program, which Chasey Harris is a customer of mine, was one of the founders of that with several others. And she was in our store a couple of years ago and just mentioned that she had some concerns about the ability to gather enough food to make contributions worthy enough for the children to make it through Christmas break. And I thought I was familiar with Porch Durham, but I didn't really know that much about it. So I asked, you know, I inquired a little bit deeper, and she went on to tell me, you know, how there are children that just don't have any food over the weekends at in their homes. And, you know, I thought about my own home where I have my child that looks in the refrigerator and says there's nothing to eat and how much food is actually in there. But in all seriousness, I thought there's something we can do to help this. And we do an annual drive in December of every year where we give our customers half off of one item in the store in exchange for a bag of items, food items that are appropriate to, you know, Porch's guidelines. And I have a friend who said, when I heard this, I thought you were either an idiot or a genius. And I may be a little bit of both. I don't know. But it's a tremendously successful event. We always, the 2 years we've done it, we raise in excess of 500 pounds of food in a 1 day event.
500 pounds of food in 1 day?
Yeah.
That's a lot of 50% discounts, it seems to me.
Well, it's a lot of food. A lot of our customers, yes, a lot of our customers do take advantage of the discounts. Some don't. Some just come and drop off food. Yeah. And, you know, that's the beauty of it. Yeah. And, you know, it's all of our staff, my staff loves to work that day. It's a very, very busy, high paced, kind of frantic work day. But it feels really good.
Yeah, Christmas time, busy time, a time when I would think that's got to be one of your most important months. That's the month you got to do it, right?
We hope to.
Yeah. So again, these sort of business decisions and community decisions, I guess in part because you're here in this case, because you're not a corporation that's from somewhere else, your relationship to the community and the people in it is vital.
Absolutely. And I've always been a firm believer that you have to give back to the community in which your business is built. And we do a lot of philanthropic good for many charities, schools. We do work with the National Transplant Foundation. We are avid supporters of the Durham Arts Council. We're a patron sponsor of Art Walk every year. We support the Durham Symphony. We have a beautiful store because of the beautiful community in which we, you know, exist. And we have to be stewards of that and, you know, contribute back.
So Durham, Raleigh, and Chapel Hill, this whole area, I think, is on the map with regard to food. Are we anywhere near a kind of a fashion scene? Are
we're
people talking
getting
about
there.
Us yet?
We're getting there. We have some up-and-coming designers in the area, and I think we are getting some great, recognition for a lot of the stores that, you know, we have in the area. And I think that, I think we have a good little unity amongst the business, the boutique owners. We all care about each other's well-being and, want us all, success. When one is successful, it's better when we're all successful because that just draws more business to your community. So, you know, you want your sister stores in your town to be
Well, that's interesting to me, too, because I've noticed it in the food industry. And I certainly have a lot of friends in the industry, both from farm to table. And it is striking how cooperative these businesses are. And they really see that competition, they are in competition by nature. That's how it works. But they don't act competitively. They act cooperatively. And it's done nothing but improve their profit picture.
Absolutely.
It does sort of make you rethink, not necessarily give lie, but make you rethink the balance of competition and cooperation in a truly competitive and successful business environment.
Well, I think, for example, Durham is a big city, but it's still very small. You know, the stores just in the downtown area, we try to be very respectful of one another and the lines that we each carry and not encroach upon that. I mean, there's a little overlap, but if we don't have something that's a line that, say, for example, Cozy carries, we send them there. We're all in this together.
Well, the other thing you think about is that with the design capabilities of an NC state, with the history and textiles that the state has, and the agricultural capacity to grow a crop like cotton if we chose, it seems to me that we're really well suited to create a fashion industry from design to manufacture to retail in the state of North Carolina. And I know there are some evidence of that. Any evidence that it's growing?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It is. The textile industry is slowly. It's very slowly, but it is coming back. I don't know if it will ever be to what it was once, but we in our shoe store, we have several sock and hosiery lines that are manufactured in North Carolina. And we try very hard to find those because we do, you know, even more so than just U.S. brands, we like to find, you know, North Carolina.
Right. Well, even when textiles were big, design was not an important part of it. But it strikes me that given the creative class and culture and the triangle, that you could now bring a whole new element to that as you revive an industry and situate yourself as the textile capital.
Absolutely.
Again, with the design element on top of it.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, exciting. And, you know, hopeful that they don't have to go to a big city to do that, that they can be right here in North Carolina and accomplish that. And I think they can.
Nancy, great to talk with you. So nice to meet you.
Thank you for having me.
Nancy McKeag, the owner of Smitten Boutique and Step Shoe Boutique in Durham. And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Go to our website, as always, stateofthings.org, to find out what we've been doing. Take a look at the archives. Leave us a message. As always, The State of Things, directed by Alex Granados, produced by Sean Nguyen and Nicole Campbell. Adija Manley and Mark Haywood are the interns. Robin Copley, the technical director. Brent Wolf, our news director. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.